One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and we have a very exciting episode for you today because, believe it or not, it was exactly 5 years ago this week that we premiered this podcast. And we have one of my all-time favorite comedians back on the show to help us celebrate, Tig Notaro. More on Tig in a minute, but first I want to thank all of you for listening to The Last Laugh. Whether you've been with us from our very first episode with Sarah Silverman in March of 2019, or have hopped on board more recently. This podcast has brought me so much joy over the past 5 years, and we literally could not have done it without you guys. So please keep listening, and if you like the show, tell your friends, and take a minute to leave a rating and review on Apple or Spotify. I realize I say that in every episode, but it would mean a lot to me, especially this week. Among our many fans, I found out this past week, is Fresno State professor David Lowe, who just put out a new book called Transgressive Humor in Classrooms that cites my interviews with Hasan Minhaj, Veer Das, Hari Kondabolu, and others. So definitely check that out if you're interested, and we'll put a link to purchase it in the description for this episode as well. We have even more exciting changes to the show that I'm eager to let you know about in the coming weeks, but I don't want to spend too much more time before getting into this very fun conversation with Tig Notaro. I feel like I don't actually need to tell you too much about Tig, besides the fact that her newest hour-long special, Hello Again, directed by her also hilarious wife, Stephanie Allen, is streaming now on Amazon Prime Video and is just fantastic. Okay, I know I just said I don't want to delay the interview any further, but before we get into it, let's listen to a clip from Tig's new special, Hello Again, in which she talks about why she thinks she might be losing her hearing, or possibly her mind.
I'm noticing, I think I have trouble with my hearing. Something's off. I always misunderstand a word or miss an entire chunk of information altogether. I'll give you a couple of examples. I was working in Toronto, and I checked in for my flight, and the woman behind the counter said, okay, you're all set. You can go hang out now in the make-believe lounge. I said, oh, yeah? Where's that? And she said, it's on the fourth floor. I said, oh, is it now? And she's just like, mm-hmm, yeah. And I said, all right, well, I guess I'm going to head up there now. And the whole time, she's just nodding her head. Yep, okay. I'm like, okay, here I go.
Well, Tig, I am so excited to have you here. I'm sure you don't know this, but this is our fifth anniversary show. It's 5 years since we launched this podcast, and I could not think of a better guest to have on than you. I really wanted to keep the energy, you know, nice and low key, but celebratory at the same time. So welcome.
That's my style. Thank you. Thanks for having me. Congrats on 5 years.
Thank you. You were on the podcast in the summer of 2020, which was about a little over 1 year in, which feels like about a million years ago. Since then, I think you've put out two specials, the animated special Drawn, and then this new one, Hello Again. You also launched a new podcast, which I love, Handsome, with two other guests who've been on this podcast as well, Mae Martin and Fortune Feimster. So yeah, you've been pretty busy.
Yeah, definitely. But it's been good. I have no real complaints. I did have complaints when I was still on the road, man. That was a long tour, but I got to tape my special and I'm really happy with things. This particular tour was just, it would not end. I was working this material out probably like 5 years ago in Los Angeles. And then I started going on this minor market tour, and then the pandemic hit, and then I had to come out of that and relearn the material and then tour again. And then the writer's strike happened, and I punted the taping of my special like 6 months just to make sure I cleared the what I hoped would be the end of the strike. Even though I technically could have taped my special, I wanted to be in solidarity and not do anything.
Yeah,
and
I feel so, like stand-up specials were one of the only things happening during the strike.
And documentaries.
Right, yeah. But yeah, the new special is great. And yeah, I had seen, I think, little bits and pieces of the material some places. I noticed that you were blessed with some new medical scares to joke about, which is always nice.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Those just keep coming. But I think that's the odd thing of having gone through what I did in 2012 with medical issues and scares and, you know, my cancer diagnosis, coming through all of that and living through it, everybody was like, oh, you did it. And then the reality is, which I started getting more comfortable talking about, is that there's still complications, there's still ongoing issues. And even though I'm doing well, I still have stuff from that time that still keeps happening. So, but I'm in a good place, but it definitely doesn't go away.
Yeah. I'm curious, you know, now that this is something that you've dealt with a lot over the years, these medical issues, and then they often become material when something happens, like the story that you tell about having to be taken to the hospital by a fireman who comes into your house after you had some intense pain.
Anyway, so I'm in bed and he says, I understand you're in pain and I want you to know there is an ambulance outside if you do need it. And I said, here's the thing, is I'm in so much pain, I don't even know if I can walk. And he said, that is not a problem. And he scooped me up in his arms. And right then I was like, ho-ho, I could get used to this. Bada bing, bada boom. Right then I was like, oh, I get it now. If you think you're shocked, how do you think I felt?
When it's happening, are you at this point already thinking, oh yeah, this is gonna be material?
No, I think I'm so caught up in the moment. I have been through so much pain in my life that like when I try and isolate things, I go, oh man, double mastectomy, that was rough. Oh man, C. diff, that was rough. Spinal fusion, that was rough. All these different things I think about, or internal bleeding, that was rough. And it's like, whatever's most recent was the most painful. And I feel like I have the highest tolerance for pain. So if I'm being hauled off in the middle of the night by an ambulance, you can bet I am in horrendous pain. And so when pain is that horrible, there is nothing I'm thinking about other than, oh my God, please don't let this be the end, you know?
And then at what point does it take that turn to say, okay, now I'm ready to laugh about this, to turn it into jokes?
Probably once I'm stabilized and I'm off Dilaudid, which is, you know, they call that hospital heroin. I lived off of that for on and off over the years. But once I'm in my sound mind and reflecting on what happened, that is when I'm like, oh my God, I cannot believe this, that, you know, it all starts adding up and starts becoming something. And trust me, there are things that haven't even become something.
Yeah, so it takes a little bit of time.
That's just what I've shared. You know, people always assume I've shared everything. I haven't shared everything.
You got to hold some stuff back for the next special, right?
Yeah.
I like how you preface, I think, one of those medical stories in this special with a sort of throwaway joke about, and, you know, usually things work out, you know, sort of alluding to your past issues.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just made me think about how your audience knows you so well at this point in a way that they obviously didn't when you were starting out and people don't know who you are. How does that change things in terms of your performance, in terms of your material, what you can talk about, this relationship that you've really developed with an audience at this point who knows you so well?
Yeah, it's interesting that you ask that because when I made that joke and comment first time, I, in the back of my mind, thought, is this going to be too subtle and they're not going to get it? I have that little, I've carried that little bit of concern every time I've done that material. I've thought, are they going to get this? And every time they, of course, do. But yeah, I think it just gives me such freedom to go anywhere and do anything. And I think also about people that are just there with a friend and they don't know what's happening. You know, when I say something that subtle of like, oh, my medical issues end up not being a big deal anyway. And everyone's like, ah, I think of friends that are there, yeah, at the show that don't know me. They're like, well, huh? But yeah, there's a definite comfort.
Yeah. Is it very noticeable when you don't have that, when you're starting out? I mean, you just have to approach things really differently and go in assuming that nobody knows anything about you?
Yeah, I guess so. And that's where you just have to figure out all the different descriptions that are necessary, what is and what isn't. Because, you know, I remember when I was first working on the Taylor Dane bit years ago, and when it wouldn't get a laugh, people would immediately say, oh, that's because, you know, she was popular in the 80s, and so nobody knows who she is. And I was like, no, that's not it, because nobody knows my mother, and I give enough description in certain stories or whatever person I'm talking about. The audience, they can't always know everyone. So, yeah, so that was... it's just an interesting lesson to learn of what's necessary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How did you fix that problem with the Taylor Dane story?
Well, I mean, the Taylor Dane story, I just had to say that she was a pop star in the 80s and just make sure that I covered that base, because that's not even what the story is about. It doesn't even matter who she was. The story is about, you know, an experiment with somebody's personality and happening over and over and over again. And it might as well be my aunt. It doesn't matter that it was Taylor Dane.
I was at this party with this friend of mine, Pam, and we were going to leave the party, and she said to me, do you know who that was standing by the door? I said, no. And she said, that was Taylor Dane. And I was like, oh my God, I love Taylor Dane. I don't know. Do you guys know Taylor Dane? Yeah, she was no, you're shaking your head, no. She was in the 80s. She was a pop singer in the 80s and 90s. She sang Love Will Lead You Back. She sang Tell It to My Heart. Yeah. Yeah. And now you're nodding your head. I'll sing it for you. I know, I just said I was going to sing. In fact, that was my idea.
I was thinking about this sort of disconnect between maybe how you're perceived and how you feel that maybe that might influence something like not being sure if people are going to get that joke, that subtle joke. And you open the special by juxtaposing these sort of overheated quotes about how you've changed comedy and that you're an action movie star now. And then we see your pre-show ritual, which is, you know, quietly eating carrots in your dressing room. Is that what you were trying to capture? Some sort of disconnect between your public and private personas there?
Well, that was my wife directed the special, and right, that was her idea. And I just thought it was so funny because she is endlessly amused by what people think, you know. Yeah, being in an action movie and in Star Trek and a stand-up that beat cancer and all of these things. And she sees me shuffling around the house in slippers and eating vegan and taking walks. And there's just nothing like that going on in my life. So, I mean, I guess eating vegan maybe is what helps cure cancer, some people believe. But anyway, so it's so great that she was able to express that in the special, because it's something that she relentlessly teases me about. Especially like when I was in that Army of the Dead movie, and I don't know if you know, but I was trending online for being sexy, yes, and hot. And of course she thinks I'm attractive. She married me, but she's just like, oh my God, that is not who I'm living with.
Yeah. Well, she didn't know she was marrying a sexy AF action star.
No,
she had no idea.
She had no idea. In fact, when we were in the editing room working on this movie we co-directed, it's called Am I Okay? It'll be coming out, I think, on HBO Max or whatever it's called this summer. But we were in the editing bay, and I kept getting all these texts that I was blowing up on Twitter for being, and I said to Stephanie, I go, what? I didn't know the trailer had come out. And I was like, people are texting me saying I'm blowing up for being sexy as AF. And what's that? And Stephanie said, oh my God, it's sexy AF, meaning sexy as fuck. And I was like, oh. And she said, it's like you're saying, when you say sexy as AF, you might as well say sexy as AF fuck.
Yeah. Or ATM machine.
Yeah, exactly. So, but yeah, she teases me about all that stuff.
Yeah. You're so sexy AF. You don't even know what sexy AF means. That's
exactly. Yeah.
So Stephanie Allen, your wife, who I'm also a big fan of, directed the special. How does that dynamic work in terms of her directing you? And I guess you're co-directing this movie as well. What's your working relationship like?
Well, we're often asked in a tone of voice like, so you guys work together in that? How did that go?
Oh my gosh.
And we love it. I can't imagine not working with her. I feel like we have such similar sensibilities, but just slightly different enough to where we elevate, a mutual idea and vision. And it's really crazy. We can read a script and both kind of come out of it with a similar note, even if it's about a word that rubbed us the wrong way. We both are like, yeah, I didn't like that. We have to change that word. But it goes really well. We've acted together. We've directed. We've produced. We've created, written, podcasted, raised kids. We've been together 11 years now. And it's just, I think it's similar to just being together, which is when there's that difference of opinion, you just have to stop and sort that out and move on. And so far, we've been able to do that in our personal life and our work life.
Is there an example of some piece of material in the special that she kind of helped you find something, or gave you a note that really that changed things, or anything like that?
I can't think of any. She doesn't give me a lot of notes on my material, but when she does give me a note, I would say she is somebody I am all ears on, because I just, to this day, she makes me laugh so, so deeply. She's so funny. I can't believe that Stephanie exists. I can't believe that I found her. I can't believe that she loved me back. This is all true. And at least once a day, she says something where I'm left utterly confused. Just unprompted, yells across the house. For instance, do you know what time Yum Yum Donuts opens? Yum Yum. No. Have you ever heard me say I gotta head down to Yum Yum Donuts? Beat the rush. I don't even know what that is. Sounds delicious, but I don't know anything about it.
Yeah, I heard that you did get notes from your kids though, the first time they saw you perform stand up.
Yes.
Is that true? You got heckled by your twin boys?
Yeah, actually just by Max. Finn was sinking in his seat, mortified. but they had only seen me they had only seen my animated special on HBO.
It makes sense.
And and then I did this vegan benefit that was at 2 p.m, maybe 6 or 9 months ago. And we had plans later that afternoon, our family. And I said to Stephanie, should we just all go to my show since it's a matinee show? And then go to wherever we were going after that. And she was like, oh, yeah, maybe that's a good idea. And it never crossed my mind that something like that would happen. And sure enough, Max, who, mark my words, he is a comedian, but he wasn't even trying to be funny. He truly was just, I think, fact-checking me. I think he I think he thought I was exaggerating or not telling the truth. And so he just piped up, "No, you didn't." And I was like, oh my gosh. And the entire audience busts into laughter. And I said, I'm so sorry. I said, my sons are here. And then I continued. And then Max kept saying, "That isn't true." And I was like, "Max." And then I eventually had to stop. I had to talk directly to him. I was like, "Max, this is true. This happened. You weren't there. We can talk about this later." And then I kept going and he was like, "Not." It wouldn't stop.
Maybe he's just very tuned into the cultural conversation about how much comedians are allowed to exaggerate. You think that's what's going on?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Quite possibly.
Did it make you, you know, think at all about, oh, should I be bending the truth this much in my comedy?
Well, I wasn't even bending the truth.
Oh, okay.
That was the issue.
He was just wrong.
Yeah, he was wrong. I was telling a story that he had no information about, and it had to do with going to Lake Bell's bachelorette party weekend.
And you're like, dude, you weren't there.
Yeah. And what set him off was I was talking about how I was in this party bus with all of these beautiful actresses and me, and people had penis hats on and were drinking out of penis straws. And he was like, "She's lying." And I think it was just the mention of the word penis. He was like, "This,
that doesn't sound like my mom, maybe."
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. She's not always talking about penises. But the party bus, while we were going down the road, started filling with exhaust while everyone's drinking and spinning around the poles. The bus starts filling with black exhaust.
Oh, God.
And breaks down on the side of the road. And I was saying, so you would see people like Cameron Diaz with a penis hat on looking underneath the party bus to see what happened. And I was talking about what a sight it was. And Max just thought I was making this up.
Yeah.
And
sounds pretty made up. I mean,
I know. It's very true. Ask Cameron Diaz. It happened.
I will. I'm going to ask her. Coming up after the break, Tig opens up about what it's been like to become a bona fide celebrity herself when she still wouldn't even recognize most celebrities if they walked into the room.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you're enjoying this episode and want to hear more, please make sure you are following The Last Laugh wherever you get your podcasts. By subscribing to The Last Laugh, you can listen to our previous episode with Tig Notaro, along with everything else from our free archive. And you'll be the first to hear new episodes when they drop every Wednesday. And while you're at it, please leave a rating and review on Apple and Spotify to let us know how much you love the show and who you want to hear next. Now, back to Tig Notaro. That reminded me of the bit in your special, another one that I really loved, about the doctor who says refers to you as a mom or whatever with the hand motion. That people can't see who are listening to this. I thought that was very funny. And you've previously joked about, I think, getting called sir at a coffee shop and things like that. But the thing
everywhere
that stood out in the joke to me was how much you gave this person the benefit of the doubt. And we're really sort of generous with their intentions. Is that sort of your general approach to these things and how you think about, do you think most people are really well-intentioned on these issues of gender identity and things like that?
I mean, there's certainly so many that aren't.
Right. And maybe the ones you encounter for the most part.
But I really did feel like she felt caught, like, not that she was trying to hurt my feelings. I meant that genuinely. She really seemed like, oh no, I don't know how this person, to me that acknowledges that she cared about how I identified. And, but it took me going home that day to sort out all of my thoughts and feelings about it. But in the moment, I still thought I was confused, but I also knew she was not trying to be hurtful. But I couldn't figure out why I knew that. And that's what I came to. I was like, oh, that weird hand gesture was actually the telltale sign that she didn't mean any harm. And so I think when people make a mistake and they mess up and they really didn't mean to and they really had good intentions, I do think it's important to acknowledge that.
Yeah, I think people who do have good intentions are probably scared about messing up.
Yes,
that's right.
She was so mortified that she had done that, and I could tell. And but I've never seen her again.
I thought it was a nice moment because I think the impulse is sometimes to go the other way and say that anyone who's making a mistake, should be condemned in some way. But it seems like people make well-intentioned mistakes in this area a lot.
All the time. And, and quite possibly other people might have been outraged by that. And maybe they feel that I should have been outraged but I processed it in the time that I did. And that's what I came to. And I feel like that bit got a really good response always. And I also think that my crowd would be a crowd that could sniff out if it was right or wrong,
So you tell a story near the end of your special about a time when you sang Adele's Hello in a room full of a lot of famous people, including, I believe, Adele, which is another insane true story, like the Cameron Diaz one that I think actually happened to you. In general, it seems like you're not overly impressed by celebrities, and often, as we learn, don't know who they are from your show Under a Rock, and which I loved. Is that sort of just been your attitude even, before you were famous yourself? Have you always been sort of unimpressed by celebrity in that way and just kind of seeing people as people?
Yeah, I guess I would want to make it clear. Sometimes I feel like unimpressed sounds
that's too negative.
Yeah. Because I'm impressed by so many of these people. But I think what it is I don't feel starstruck.
Right.
And that's another thing Stephanie and I have very much in common. We both can't figure it out why Obama walked in the room, or
You wouldn't get a little, you know, your heart wouldn't start beating any faster.
I mean, but I would be like, oh my God, there's Barack Obama. And I would be interested to talk to him and meet him. Same with somebody like Oprah or whoever it is. I would say I have a little bit of a weakness though with musicians. And so I had the opportunity to interview Chrissy Hynde one time for Spin Magazine. And she wanted me to come out to New York to do the interview in person. And I don't know. I guess I was a bit starstruck there and did not want to meet her.
What do you think it is about musicians that makes you more starstruck?
Probably the same reason people are more interested in actors, because they're following that. I just don't follow TV and film closely. And that is, I'm sure, confusing because I'm in TV and film, but, but it's a real thing. I asked my son the other day, I said, "Have you ever seen me watch TV?" And he said, "No." He was like, "Why?" And I said, "I don't know. Just somebody was asking me." And I told them that I don't really watch. And so I was curious if you had any recollection of seeing me watch TV. And he was like, "No." But I obviously have seen TV and film, and I obviously work with celebrities and I've socialized with celebrities, but I'm missing a huge chunk. And I know so much more now than I did when I moved to LA 28 years ago. It was, I mean, talk about chip off the old block. I remember my mother, I mentioned Arnold Schwarzenegger at one point before he was governor, and she had never heard of him. But
that's where you get it from?
That's where I come from. So I think there's certain musicians that just kind of send me a bit and can kind of, make me a little less, I blow my cool a little bit.
You tell stories about celebrities, whether it's that one you were just mentioning about the bachelorette party, or there's a story in the new special about a meeting with Reese Witherspoon. Do these people who, some of whom are your friends, do you warn them that you're going to talk about them on stage? Do they think about it at all, or have any concerns that you're sort of telling stories about them in your act? Or do they kind of assume that that's going to happen if they're friends with you?
I mean, I didn't tell Reese about that story. I was just telling it on stage. And then I did that for maybe Prairie Home Companion or some public radio show I told it on. And then I told it on public radio. Oh, and then I told it on Colbert once.
Oh, yeah. I think I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Reese said, "I'm 5'1". She said, "Laura Dern is 5'10", Nicole Kidman is 5'11", and Shailene's 5'8". Mm-hmm. And then I interjected, "Oh my gosh, that's so interesting, because years ago I dated a woman that was 6 feet tall, and I think she was kind of insecure about her height, so she hunched." And then we wrapped up the meeting and it was like, "Okay, bye-bye." And we walked out, and then Stephanie said, "What in the hell were you talking about in there?" And that's when I realized that I didn't know that there was an actress named Shailene. And so what I heard was that Nicole Kidman was 5'11", and she leans 5'8". And when I told it on Colbert, I don't know if I reached out and told Reese or if somebody from her office sent it to her, but she was well aware of it and she thought it was hilarious. And, but I don't think I've ever, even with the Taylor Dane story, my intention there wasn't to attack Taylor Dane, because sometimes people got the wrong idea and they would be like, "Yeah, what, how rude, like what? And I was like, oh, I don't care that that happened. To me, it was more of, it was truly an experiment of like, this is so interesting to have this opportunity over and over again to try this out on her and see how she reacts. But I don't feel like my intentions are ever, I'm never going after anyone.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you feel like a celebrity, whether it's on that level or not, but at this point in your career, do you sort of take that in and think of yourself in that way? And how has that changed since you started out? Because you've obviously become a lot more famous, I think, you know, in the last, you know, whatever it is, 10, 15 years.
Yeah, I guess I know I am a celebrity, or as, again, my son Max, who heckled me, I took him to martial arts class. And when we left, we were going to get in the car, and this other kid from the class, he and his mother were getting in the car next to us. And she said, "Are you Tig Notaro?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Oh," she was saying something. And then you hear Max in the car. He said, "Quit bragging about being a public figure." You just hear that voice coming out of the car. And I was like, "Max, I am not bragging about being a public figure. Oh my God." Yeah, I guess I know I'm a celebrity. I don't identify with it at all, at all, at all, at all, at all. One day I came home by myself, and when I walked in, the alarm said, "Side door open." And our son started yelling, "Mommy's home, mommy's home." That's what they call Stephanie. And then I came around the corner, and our son Finn looked back at me and then looked at his brother and said, "It's just her." As if to say, don't even bother even slightly turning your head. The letdown is so monumental. Learn from my mistake.
So now what I want to do is our segment called The First Laugh. It's how we end the show. And I'm going to start with the question, what is the first piece of comedy that made you laugh really hard as a kid growing up?
I would say Amelia Bedelia books. Oh, Are you familiar with Amelia Bedelia? Oh my gosh. That's like...
This connects well to what we were just talking about, actually, right?
Yeah, the
idea
awkward.
That she's constantly misunderstanding what's going on.
Yeah. Oh my, that must be why I connect with her. But when I was a kid, you know, of course it's so fun when circle time, story time is happening. But when Amelia Bedelia books came out, I was like, oh my gosh. It was like... like candy. I couldn't wait to hear what was going to happen.
There's real comedy in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was a big influence on me.
Clearly, yeah.
My mother, Amelia Bedelia, all of those. That's for sure one of my first. Aside from my mother. My mother was very, very funny. But outside of her, I would say Amelia Bedelia.
What about the first time that you knew you were funny, that you could make other people laugh?
Gosh, I don't know.
You've just always been funny?
Maybe. I remember one of the first times that I think I wrote a joke, but it wasn't, nobody thought it was funny. I think it was too subtle.
Yeah. Do you remember what it was?
Yeah. I was in maybe first grade. Yeah. And I was at lunch sitting at the table with my friends, and I took out a bag of Fritos, or the kid sitting next to me took out a bag of Fritos and the kid sitting next to me opened their Frito bag, the little tiny Frito bag, upside down. And I made a joke about how, oh no, now you're going to be eating upside down Fritos. And I thought that was the funniest thing in the world. I mean, I couldn't even deal with how funny that was.
It just went right over the heads of all the other six-year-olds.
Yeah. And I used to come up with different things similar to that and draw cartoons of like a bank truck with the back door wide open and money flying out of it, you know, just all of the, or like I would draw a gas, one of those big long gasoline trucks out of gas. And I don't know, just all of that really amused me as a kid.
Yeah. So that was your first joke, I guess, you wrote as a kid. What was the first joke or bit that you had as a stand-up that you were like, oh, I think I might have something here that you could go back to and was consistently getting a laugh?
Well, it's my first joke, which is a real story, and it continued to do well, which was a conversation that a friend of mine was in this band, this friend I knew from Texas when I lived there. I was living in Colorado at the time, and his band was going on tour. They were going to be performing in Denver. He gave me his road manager's number for me to call to get tickets to the show. And so I called this guy and I said, hey, you know, blah, blah, blah. I'm his friend getting tickets. And he told me to call this number. And the guy said, okay. And I said, hey, my name's Tig. And then he said, all right, well, I don't feel real comfortable calling you this, but I guess I'll see you tonight, pig. And I said, well, to tell you the truth, I don't feel real comfortable with you calling me pig either. I said, my name is actually Tig. And he said, yeah, that's what I said, pig. And I said, no, it's Tig with a T. And he said, tit? And I said, and that's where it ended in real life. And then in the joke, I just say, yeah, that's right. It's pig tit. And so that was my first joke, and I did it for, you know, the first couple of years. Yeah.
And it has the added bonus of helping people remember your name.
That's right. And it also has the bonus of me being called pig tit for the first couple of years of my stand-up career.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you remember about your late night stand-up debut? I was trying to figure it out. Was it the stool on Conan, or was there a previous late night stand-up set before that?
I did a very, I don't know. It was on Jimmy Kimmel. That was my first time. You know, it wasn't great. It wasn't terrible. It was just like, oh, here's my first time. And I didn't fully nail it, but I didn't fully bomb. I just told some jokes and then disappeared. Yeah, I got by, and then I was never seen again.
Were you worried that was what was going to happen?
Well, no, I'm just saying, like, they didn't have me back.
Oh, they didn't have you back.
Yeah, they were like,
Jimmy Kimmel show.
No,
again.
No, they weren't like, oh my God, we got to get her back. But after that, I would say it was the next time was Conan. And then I had the opposite happen where I had a really good set. And then went on my way home, my manager called to say that Conan told his producer to have me back, I think the next week or something. It was very quickly that he wanted me as like a regular on the show. And I was like,
that's
wow,
incredible.
That I did not see that coming, because I also couldn't get arrested to get on the Tonight Show. So I like never could get on that. And then had that mediocre Jimmy Kimmel spot. And then the doors blew open with Conan. And
well,
then
thank God
I think,
for Conan.
I mean, truly, I think I went on his show like 20 times. So yeah.
So good.
He's the best.
Yeah. What do you remember about the first time you met one of your really big comedy heroes, someone who you just really looked up to, and what it was like to meet them for the first time?
I met Joan Rivers, and I saw her once. I was waiting for a friend's flight who was running late, and I went into a coffee shop near LAX to wait. And this, you know, stretch limousine pulls up to the coffee shop, and out comes Joan Rivers. That wasn't when I met her, but that was the first time I saw her where I was like, oh, whoa, Joan Rivers, you know?
Yeah.
I was like, wow, awesome.
That's show business.
Yeah. And just like a stretch limo pulling up to some random coffee shop by LAX. God, yeah. It was so weird. But it was just so fun to sit there and watch her just like order her coffee and
be
go.
In the world.
Yeah. But then I met her, I can't remember, it's some, maybe it was a roast. Maybe it was a roast of Joan Rivers. And yeah, she was just very nice and Joan Riversy. And it was just fun because my mother was such a big Joan Rivers fan. So was I. And, you know, when she would sit in for Carson on The Tonight Show, it was such a highlight in our family. And so it was just, it was fun to meet her after watching her for so many years.
That's great. Finally, do you have a story or memory from your career that really makes you laugh now, but was not funny when it happened?
You should send these questions ahead of time.
I know I should.
This could
describe
dead
most
air.
Of your material. We can cut out the dead air, but this could describe a lot of your material, I think. But
yeah,
but I don't know
true.
If you, what you think is funny at the time or not. But yeah, so something if there's anything
yeah,
that comes
I guess,
to mind.
I guess the one that really connects is when my mother died and the hospital sent the questionnaire asking my mother how her stay at the hospital went. And I mean, when I was at her house, you know, we're making funeral arrangements and we get this in the mail asking us to fill out, like, was it too loud in your room? Was your doctor listening to your needs? And my mother had zero brain activity and was taken off life support. And so in the moment when I got that, I was so enraged and I wanted to devote my life to making sure this never happened to anyone else. And for those that this has happened to, I'm sorry, I did not devote my life to it, but yeah. And then I was just going about my day one day and I was like, oh my God, I cannot believe they sent that questionnaire. You know, I mean, I don't know if that's the right answer because it wasn't something that was in my career that was not funny.
But it's in your life, but it became a great part of your material. So,
yeah,
and it's something that was definitely not funny.
It was so, I was devastated when I got that. I was so mad. I was so sad. I was just like fetal position in bed type. No. And then it became the most outrageously hilarious thing. Oh my God.
I love that.
So crazy. Yeah.
Well, Tig, thank you for being here again. I'm so honored that you were here for our big fifth anniversary show.
Me too. What a fun time. 5 years.
Yeah. Woohoo.
I'm having some vegan chia pudding to celebrate.
Oh. Lovely. That's fantastic. Well, you're one of my all-time favorites, and I'm so thrilled that you took the time to be here. And
well, thanks for having
special
me.
And everything else, and I'll be looking forward to your movie with Stephanie.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tig.
See ya. Bye.
Was that the best or what? I want to thank Tig Notaro so much for coming back on the podcast to help us mark this 5-year anniversary. I still can't believe I've been doing it that long and hope we get at least another 5 years out of this thing, right? You can stream Tig's new special, Hello Again, right now on Amazon Prime Video. If you want to support The Last Laugh, please help us out by leaving a rating and review on Apple and Spotify. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Threads at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram and Threads, where you can see photos and videos from our episodes and see who is coming up next on the show. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.